hostile. They could blitz the planet with laser rays for all he cared, because for William Godfrey, a life without power was no life at all. But if they didn't come, or at least until they did, he would fight tooth and nail to hang on to what he had. And if fate should insist that William Godfrey was going down, he sure as hell wasn't going down alone. C-5. Feathers Antiques, Salida, Colorado. Before any searching began, and at Emma's strict insistence, the Feathers had signed a quickly edited version of the contract she prepared before leaving Birchwood earlier in the day. In exchange for their cooperation and silence, the discovery of the fourth plaque meant that the Feathers were now due to receive a cool $10 million from Timo Fiori. The installment-based payment schedule would hold back the majority of the money for long enough to ensure that the brothers would indeed stay quiet for a period of many years, and it would also simultaneously temper the difficulty of explaining the source of their newfound wealth to anyone who might inquire. Laundering was perhaps too strong a word, but Timo understood the concern and assured Andrew that there would be no problems on that front. He exaggerated only slightly in saying he had more money men on his payroll than he had bones in his body, and he was up front in sharing his assessment that the brothers' antiques business presented an ideal cover story for significant cash influxes given the eternal plausibility of big fines and equally big sales. What the contract did not afford the Feather Brothers, as Michael was now learning to his palpable frustration, was a guaranteed right to see the plaque's engravings. Dan would have had no problem in showing them, and no great precautions had been taken thus far. After all, the Feathers had participated fully in the search. But Emma cautiously encouraged him to keep the plaque to himself, and to not even look at the engravings until it was safely back in the car and on its way to Birchwood. Dan ran his hand over the smooth rear surface of the plaque. "We need to check it's actually engraved before we leave," he said. "Check in the car," Emma replied. "We don't want to involve them in anything we don't have to, especially when we wouldn't know what the anything is until it was too late."
"I'd say we're already pretty involved," Michael protested. "After all, we did help you find the damn thing. And what exactly is it that you think could be on there that you don't want us to see?"
Emma didn't back down. "You'll be paid millions of dollars per hour for that help once the plaque's origin is verified," she said. "And as for your second question, I'll refer you to what I just said. We don't know what it's going to say. That's the point."
Andrew Feather encouraged his brother to drop this point, telling him that Dan wasn't going to keep the plaque's message a secret for long, and that they would see the engraving when everyone else did. Michael eventually accepted this without looking too pleased. Clark directed Tara to an old shopping bag on the floor and asked if she could hand it to Dan. His own injured ribs weren't happy with the idea of him bending down to pick it up. Tara rolled the bag into a loose ball and tossed it to Dan.
"Put it in there without looking at the front," Clark suggested.
Dan hesitated.
"You really think I should carry a message from aliens in an old shopping bag?"
"Well," Andrew Feather interjected with a high-spirited grin, "the Argentines did lift an alien sphere out of the ocean in an old shark cage."
This comment broke the tension and prompted Dan, laughing in the absence of a suitable riposte, to do as Clark said. He surprised himself greatly by not sneaking a look at the engraved side of the plaque. However much anyone else wanted to know what it said, he needed to know even more. And this self-restraint came as a result of his understanding that Emma was right when she said there was no sense in involving the Feathers any more than they already were. His inevitably expressive reaction, one way or the other, would likely have left little to their imagination and made it more difficult to convince Michael to be patient. While the contract didn't guarantee that the Feathers could see the engraving, it likewise didn't expressly state that they couldn't. Dan nevertheless opted to keep it from them, however. Loath to cause Emma any more headaches, and equally reluctant to make the Feathers' job of keeping their mouths shut any more difficult than it had to be by sharing with them the nature of the messenger's latest engravings. With the plaque safely in the bag, Dan lifted the box it had been found inside back up to the empty space on the shelving unit. He then carefully made his way across the makeshift bridge back to the relatively clear side of the overflowing outbuilding. Once back on safe footing, he made a point of shaking both of the brothers' hands and thanking them for their help. If Michael had borne any resentment over not seeing the plaque, it faded in this moment.
"Honored," he said very simply. Andrew encouraged Dan to hurry up and get home so the plaque could be shared with the world sooner rather than later.
"Because if you think I'm going to sleep before I know what it says," he said with a laugh.
After a quick group photo taken by Michael at Dan's request, the rest of the group's goodbyes were short and sweet. Andrew Feather's final words came as he pointed out how weird it was that the plaque's discovery in the tiny little mountain town of Salida was so in keeping with the final line of the prophecy taken as gospel by countless plaque-hunting finchers. "A triad of great discoveries will bridge the gap between soil and star, arising from the shadow of the Alps to delve the depths of the Silver Ocean and gaze upon the rockiest peak that lies beyond. From Toplitz to Miramar to Salida, it had all come to pass." Dan, understanding a lot more than the Feathers about the nature of the first two discoveries, had no idea whether the messengers had paid any heed to this prophecy or whether the fourth plaque had turned up in the Rockies because they were on his doorstep and hence easily reachable. On the one hand, it made sense to him that the messengers might have played along with such a prevalent theory so that the location of the plaque's eventual discovery didn't seem completely random. But on the other, he knew how dangerous it was to make any assumptions about alien motives, thought processes, or philosophies, particularly when it came to considering how the messengers might act based on their own potentially imperfect observational assumptions about how humanity might react to any given action. What counted for now was that the plaque was safely in Dan's possession. So he put such thoughts to the side and held the bag tightly. Outside, everyone quickly retook their seats in Emma's car in the same positions as they had for the outward leg of their trip. At Clark's sensible suggestion, Emma drove a few hundred meters away from the Feather's home before pulling up and telling Dan that it was safe to open the bag and take a look, without having to worry about stifling any visual or vocal reactions that might follow.
"No one watch when I first look," he said quietly, a request rather than an instruction. "I don't want everyone staring at my face."
"You want me to grab that bag and look for you?" Clark asked. "Just look." The others afforded more respect to Dan's request, although Emma did briefly gaze into the rearview mirror to gauge his reaction, and Timo did strain his eyes looking to the side as his head faced the window. Dan could hardly blame them. Timo had been through almost as much as he had, and he knew that he wouldn't have survived a week of the IDA leak without Emma. So he didn't repeat his shy request, even though he noticed their peeking. Clark chose to stare rather than peek, while Tara both turned her head away and closed her eyes. An intense feeling of anxious anticipation grew and tumbled around in Dan's stomach. He had felt this only once before, when he'd stood on Winchester Street and gazed down at a manila folder with a label marked Kaer Gallen. With every fiber of his being, he hoped that the object he now held in his hands would not prove to be another Pandora's box. Beyond anything else, he hoped that the message on this plaque would finally and decisively clean up the mess he had unwittingly unleashed by first picking up that wretched folder and then anonymously sharing its contents online. Everything came down to this. With no further fanfare and no dramatic pause, Dan lifted the plaque from the bag and immediately turned it around to see the front.
"It's real," Timo said, betraying his furtive peeking.
Dan ignored this neutrally toned comment and took in every detail of the message he was looking at. It took almost no time for the obvious conclusion to be cemented and for his lips to part and share the news.
"I was right," he said, unable to contain his excitement. "It's a star map with two scales, one showing the brightest stars as we see them from Earth, and the other zoomed way in to show more. Timo, look, there's a square on the zoomed-out version, and the zoomed-in version shows everything inside that square in more detail. But then there's a small triangle on the close-up showing us exactly where to look, exactly where to go. Emma, I was right."
Emma turned to gaze directly at Dan. There had been no gloating in his voice, and there was nothing but joy in her eyes. Almost rendered speechless, Timo gently rubbed his fingertips over the small engraved triangle. Is this? Is it really?
Damn right! Dan McCarthy boomed, smiling the widest smile of his post-disclosure life so far. It's the way to New Kerguelen!
C-4. Drive-in, Birchwood, Colorado.
Word on the street says this announcement Slater is about to make is that we're pulling out of the GSC,
Phil Norris said, sipping a beer alongside his two best friends and customers.
What street? Mr. Bird laughed. Don't get me wrong, it could be about that, but don't act like you have some insider info.
I'm no fan of Slater, but I hope this is the withdrawal announcement, Henry chimed in. Global anything is a bad idea. Guys like Godfrey, whichever side of all the left versus right crap they pretend to be on, these guys just want to be in control. And when the thing they're fighting to be in control of isn't the government of one country, but the government of every country, the government of the whole damn world, somehow we expected that to go well?
No disagreements for me on that one, Phil said. The other possibility, as I see it, is that some American astronomers or data analysts have found something big. There are still some good private observatories here that don't answer to Godfrey's goons, so maybe someone has found a hole in his story about everything that's going on.
Henry, who had been midway through a long hospital stay when President Slater made the famous disclosure announcement a year earlier, shrugged and blew air from his lips.
I guess. All I know is that if someone has found something new, it's going to be no good for anyone if they take it to the GSC.
C-3. White House, Washington, D.C. For the first time since the Kerguelen bolide of 7 days earlier, President Slater stood in front of the nation's press to address growing concerns and anger over the absence of a decisive GSC response to recent events. She had been pressed for comment on countless GSC-related issues throughout the past year, opting to keep out of disputes over everything from the precise funding formula to the occasionally aggressive actions of the organization's security corps whenever she reasonably could. Other national leaders had respected the spirit of the New York Agreement by maintaining the same detachment, with the notable recent exception of the provocative words delivered via the British Prime Minister's widely detested proxy, Jack Neal. By and large, Chairman Godfrey had kept things in check from his operational base in the heart of Buenos Aires, but in the face of his greatest challenge yet, the ball had well and truly been dropped, and at a time when GSC buildings in some regions of the world were being defended with water cannons and rubber bullets, dignified silence in deference to a handshake agreement was no longer a responsible course of action. My fellow Americans, Slater began, looking and sounding far stronger than she had during the disclosure announcement, which remained the defining moment of her presidency, despite an economically successful and socially cohesive year in the interim. I do not need to remind anyone that we live in a post-disclosure world. I do not need to remind anyone that I sat here just a year ago, joined by many of the same journalists who are here again today, and that I delivered to this great nation the difficult news that we are not alone. The news was difficult not primarily because of its intrinsic content, but rather primarily because of the circumstances surrounding it, because of the secrecy surrounding the initial discovery in Lake Toplitz, and because of the outright obstructiveness and unforgivable duplicity of a certain Richard Walker. I am here today to address the great deal of speculation and conjecture which has engulfed our country and our planet over the last few days, much of it whipped up by irresponsible media reporting about the nature and meaning of recently observed celestial events. I have personally seen a thorough internal GSC report on Tuesday's unexpected satellite reentry, and what I can reveal today is that this report has satisfactorily addressed our concerns regarding the national security implications of that particular incident. As for yesterday's extraordinary fireball in California, I have been informed that, as visually spectacular as it was, this kind of incident isn't as spectacularly uncommon as many of us think. But given what we now know about our place in this universe, what I will not stand here and do is pretend that the timing of these events, particularly when considered alongside the location of the Kerguelen bolide, is something that we can dismiss out of hand as a mere curiosity of random chance.
Although the attendant reporters were already paying attention to Slater's words, this comment caused more than a few ears to prick up and more than a few surprised glances to be exchanged. It occurs to me that the anti-GSC protests in which many upstanding citizens have participated have been driven by two compounding factors, anger and fear. Anger at a perceived lack of action in Buenos Aires is perfectly understandable. Perfectly understandable. What frustrates me on a personal level is that this understandable anger would not be manifesting itself if the GSC's public-facing communications were fit for purpose. I know that Chairman Godfrey is overseeing meaningful research and development into defensive projects as well as exploratory ones, but the culture of secrecy which pervades at the GSC ensures that members of the public, again quite understandably, tend to confuse a lack of updates for a lack of activity. I do not consider the anger that the GSC has faced to be misdirected or misplaced. I consider it to be the fault of poor communication. I consider it to be avoidable and, more positively, I consider it to be highly remediable. Without wishing to diminish the broadly held feelings which I have repeatedly stressed that I consider quite understandable, the ease with which the problem of anti-GSC sentiment can be solved means that I am not overly concerned by the recent outpouring of public anger. I will say more on the GSC in a moment, but first I want to touch on something which does concern me. Fear. If we are not careful, and if we are not proactive, fear can consume all. Each and every one of us will recall the difficult weeks and months which followed our initial analysis of the first two plaques, and which came to a head following the failed launch of DS-1. None of us need to be reminded of the violence and chaos which blighted some regions when understandable but incorrect conclusions were drawn from the engravings on those plaques, and none of us need to be reminded of how greatly that violence was exacerbated when the media pushed a narrative that our last hope of defending our planet had died with DS-1. What I believe many of us do need to be reminded of is how quickly the discovery and analysis of the third plaque quashed everything. When the context provided by that plaque eased so many fears in the blink of an eye, it became clear that all we ever had to fear truly was fear itself. And if the peace that has followed the discovery of the third plaque in Salzburg has shown us anything, it has shown us that we have nothing to fear from any further messages we may discover or indeed receive from our extraterrestrial counterparts. Once again, this comment excited several reporters. No one called out any questions. Of late, Slater had been commanding a lot more respect from the press than she used to, but she couldn't miss the change in their expressions as eyebrows rose all around the room. "For a year," she went on, "we have known that we are not alone in the universe. We have known this in an abstract way, with no direct contact or real-time observation. But given recent events, beginning with a powerful bolide at a location so improbable and apposite as Kerguelen, and continuing with these similar incidents so soon afterwards, we cannot fully rule out the notion that we may be on the verge of a real-time observation sooner than many of us expected. For a year we have known in an abstract sense that we are not alone. And what I wish to stress today is that there is no reason for fear as we reflect on the possibility that one day soon we may also know it in a more immediate, more physical sense. In the meantime," Slater continued, raising her pitch slightly and picking up the pace, "we should all afford the GSC the time it needs to analyze these recent events. Where I differ from Chairman Godfrey is in my view that we should give a reasonably fair hearing to any private groups with the competence and finances to assist in productive space-related endeavors which can and will benefit humanity as a whole. Cooperation, rather than conflict, is the order of the day. Today and every day, and I sincerely hope that such cooperation will prevail." A few hushed murmurs greeted these wholly unexpected comments, which could only be taken as a highly public attempt by President Slater to pressurize Chairman Godfrey into reconsidering his policy of freezing out Timo Fiori's well-funded and highly ambitious plans for Fiori Frontieri. Some had believed that Slater might rebuke Godfrey's leadership more generally, or even announce a once-unthinkable U.S. withdrawal from his crisis-stricken GSC. None had believed that Slater might half-heartedly support Godfrey with one breath before pushing him towards an embarrassing Timo-related climb-down with the next. But leaving all of that aside, I want to close with an important reminder that regardless of what we ultimately find out about the possibility of a pattern behind recent events, and regardless of what we find out about the specific causes of each individual incident, the crucial thing to remember is that not a single person has been physically injured.
The gathered journalists had watched and listened to Slater enough times to recognize the shift in tone, which suggested that she had reached the end of her speech. But each continued to pay rapt attention in anticipation as to the nature of her closing remark. Slater paused for effect and gave a very slight smile of confident reassurance before delivering her final line. "Ladies and gentlemen, if this is a precursor to contact, then contact is nothing to be feared."
C-2. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado.
"I can't even pretend to understand what just happened," Emma said, reacting to President Slater's comments as the rest of the equally confused group, other than the thoroughly preoccupied Dan, waited eagerly for her interpretation. "She's doing what's popular by criticizing the GSC's culture of secrecy and saying Timo should be allowed to contribute, and she's doing what's safe by diplomatically supporting Godfrey's position, but I really don't know what's going on with the contact stuff. It was almost a tease, like she knows something."
"Maybe the craft Trey recorded was seen by others?" Timo suggested.
No one knew any more on this point, of course, and Dan's trend ticker displayed an appropriate scrolling post from Billy Kendrick, which simply restated his belief that a lot more is going on here than any of us know right now. Dan, for his part, was busy on his computer looking for named stars, which, when viewed from Earth, fell within the relatively small zone revealed on the alien plaque. He had barely taken his eyes off it during the drive back from Salida, and he had barely spoken a word to anyone since getting it down into his basement. The few words he did speak were to Alessandro Bonucci, who had been entrusted with detailed photographs of the plaque and who was already remotely controlling powerful telescopes housed at some of Timo's isolated and well-positioned facilities around the world. While Dan was poring through lists of stars already known to be orbited by other exoplanets, Alessandro was stepping up the detection process. He and countless other astronomers had publicly stated on several occasions that one of the greatest obstacles to detecting exoplanets or alien signals was, quite obviously, knowing where to look for them. With a specific target now in hand, he was able to point much of the world's most expensive and most advanced deep space observation equipment towards an area of the sky which both he and Dan McCarthy now believed to house New Kerguelen's home system. Observation would hold the answers, but one step was necessary before they could pursue off-Earth observation of New Kerguelen and ultimately justify the focused development of the technologies needed to reach the distant world. Before any of that could come to pass, they had to prove it was there. The plaque's map was one thing, but direct and replicable observation was something else. Dan wasn't concerned that Alessandro hadn't reported any findings just yet, since hardly any time had passed. President Slater's televised words had gone in one of Dan's ears and straight out the other, as had Timo's reasonable suggestion that she might have been informed that the messengers had briefly flown over Montana in the moments after the widely observed satellite burn-up.
"Dan," Clark called, finally getting his attention. "What do you think?"
He looked over and saw a series of confused faces, some of their expressions bordering on concern.
What do I think about what?"
Emma walked over to Dan and sat in the chair next to him before succinctly recapping Slater's key points.
"What I think about that is that she doesn't know about this,"
he replied after hearing it all out, more relaxed than anyone else. "If the messengers were spotted by anyone else, they wanted to be. They don't make mistakes. They wanted us to find the plaque first, and we did. But see, that's the thing. They wanted there to be a plaque. They could have just told me where to look for New Kerguelen or made me draw this star map like they made me draw the road map to Lolo. Remember? In the cornfield? And they wanted there to be a plaque because they want everyone to know this came from them. This way there's no debate. There's no one saying I'm crazy or an attention-seeking publicity hound or anything else like that. I don't know why we had to find it first, and I don't know why they didn't just leave it at Walker's place when they took him. That way, we would have had it without needing to get the feathers involved. But what I know for sure is that the messengers don't do things for no reason, and they don't make mistakes.
It could be a trail of credibility or something like that,
Tara said. Dan nodded.
Maybe.
We don't know, but they do. That's what counts.
Timo, still partly running on Italian time, found himself gazing at Dan's bed as Slater's face left the screen and the Blitz News analysis team took her place.
So, as for tonight, should I call a driver at the hotel or...
No need, Emma answered.
Oh, really? Clark interjected, a boyish lilt in his voice. So where will Dan be spending the evening?
Tara tried not to laugh.
Give us a break, man, Dan said. Things are complicated enough. Just dial down on the Clark, okay?
Emma gently squeezed Dan's hand, despite the other's attention rather than because of it.
This isn't complicated, she told him, looking into his eyes before turning to Clark. But yeah, dial down on the Clark, Clark. We're not in middle school.
Clark chuckled dryly at having his own words of several days earlier fired back in the opposite direction. He then turned more serious as he looked at them. It was an awkward kind of seriousness, and one he wasn't at all used to.
And, obviously, I care about both of you a lot, he said, his voice less resonant and sure of itself than normal. So just, you know, be careful not to get hurt or whatever.
They knew what he meant and understood the sentiment behind his words, as inarticulate as the words themselves may have been.
And Emma... Be careful, Tara added with a wink, greatly elongating the word careful for the sake of light-hearted emphasis. Because, you know, at your age, 32, Emma said, rolling her eyes at Tara's attempt at humor.
Tara held a finger to her lips and whispered,
People can hear you.
A hint of a grin appeared on Emma's face, despite her best efforts not to let Tara know that her joke had landed a hit.
Anyway, we've all had a long day. A long week.
Clark stood up, able to do so without too much pain as his injuries from the previous night continued to fade. He struggled to believe that only 24 hours had passed since he ran into the messenger's force field, and Emma's mention of a long day was putting it lightly to say the least.
It's so weird going to bed knowing that we found what we were looking for, Tara said. Like, what do we do now?
Sleep, Clark suggested.
Good plan.
She replied, heading for the stairs while Dan, as exhausted as anyone else, once again disabled the basement's access controls for Timo's benefit before powering down his computer and picking up the plaque to keep it safely by his side.
Alessandro might call this phone if he has any status updates, Timo said. Should I answer it?
Yeah, if it's him, Dan said. No one else should call. Hardly anyone even has the number. But if they do, don't pick up. Call me and I'll come over.
What if I see anything important on TV? Clark asked. Do you want me to call you too?
Dan shrugged.
If by important you mean something we actually need to act on, then yeah, obviously. But not if it's just the usual crap on the news.
Nothing much will happen tonight, Emma predicted. Alessandro is doing his thing, and Slater's sideshow is probably going to kick off in the meantime, with everyone talking about what you might know about contact. But that's what it'll be for now. Talk. Alessandro sounded pretty confident that he would have something quite soon, so I don't think there's going to be time for any major trouble to get going before he does. I think the worst is over.
Oh, definitely, Dan stressed, climbing the stairs. I'd even say that all of the bad stuff is over, not just the worst of it. Well, maybe except for some neck pains, if or when the messengers ever finally feel like showing up for real.
Emma laughed.
I wasn't joking, Dan said, lowering his voice. I still think they're coming back.
C-minus 1. Cavalieri Observatory, Trento, Italy. When his classmates had dreamed of scoring the winning goal in the World Cup final, Alessandro Bonucci had dreamed of a night like this. The discovery of any exoplanet had seemed unlikely in those days, but a discovery like the one that was now within his grasp, the discovery of a planet which was either the current home to intelligent extraterrestrials or a hand-picked second home for humanity, well, a discovery like that had been beyond his wildest dreams. Timo Fiori trusted Alessandro more than anyone else, and Alessandro didn't take this trust lightly.
He followed every protocol and every instruction to the letter, ensuring that other workers who had to know he was up to something wouldn't know what that something was. Alessandro knew what he was looking for, and he knew why it had to be kept quiet for now. Observable confirmation of New Kerguelen's existence and location was the jackpot. But Alessandro didn't dismiss the possibility that what he might come across was a new kind of message in the form of a signal. For that reason, he keenly directed all manner of telescopes at the target zone and pored over the incoming data like a day trader analyzing 15 screens at once. Even the radio telescopes at his home facility were involved in the search for something meaningful in the target zone, along with faraway telescopes designed for deep space observation for planetary defense purposes, and of course those housed in TIMO's several exoplanet hunting facilities around the world. Despite all of this data being fed directly to Alessandro, for many hours there was nothing of note. Nothing, nothing, and a whole lot more nothing. But then suddenly, there was something. A pop-up window containing a barrage of new data fields flashed up on one of the screens, immediately capturing his full attention. He wheeled his chair down the long line of screens until he was directly in line with the pop-up, at which point his eyes took in the incredible data. "Oh my God," Alessandro said out loud. He quickly moved to another screen which relayed data from the same kind of telescope at a different facility and typed in a series of commands to direct the second telescope to the precise focus of the first. He waited, waited, and waited some more, obsessively rechecking the first screen and fidgeting impatiently until a familiar pop-up appeared on the second. And there it was. The observations were distinct, and the result was replicable. No two ways about it. But beyond merely reporting that two telescopes had found the same distant thing, the two screens contained identical data as to its precise nature and meaning. "No," Alessandro said, speaking out loud as the reality of what he was looking at slowly sank in. "No way." The words and numbers before Alessandro's eyes were not the kind he had dreamed of. Instead, these observations and the meaning of this find were the stuff of nightmares. His head fell into his hands. "No, no, 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 no." Part 6. Il Diavolo. All truths are easy to understand once they are discovered. The point is to discover them. Galileo Galilei. Friday. C-0. Ford Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. Sometime between 4 and 5 in the morning, Dan was abruptly awoken by the sound of his phone vibrating its way across Emma's bedside table. He tried to reach it before it woke her too. She was exhausted, but it fell to the floor before he got there. "Who the hell is that?" she groaned. Dan picked up his phone, glad to see the screen in one piece, and saw Timo's name. "It's Timo," he said, swiping his finger to take the call. "You're awake," Timo said. "Good. I need to tell you something important. I'm outside." Dan flicked the switch on an overhanging wall lamp and pointed to Emma's bedroom door, silently telling her that Timo was outside. They both stood up. "Is everything okay?" Dan asked. Timo hesitated for long enough to render a verbal answer unnecessary. He eventually replied with a simple, "No." But Dan reached the front door to let him in before any elaboration came. Rooster, doubtless confused as to why everyone was awake so early, lazily watched on. Having thrown on a satin robe, Emma had already taken an impatient seat on the couch to hear what was so important at this hour. But although no one looked their sharpest, she rose to her feet immediately when she saw the paleness of Timo's face. Her impatience dissipated in an instant, replaced by palpable apprehension. "Is someone dead?" Dan asked. Given Timo's expression and pallor, this was a reasonable enough question. Timo stepped inside and briefly closed his eyes and gulped several times, as though fighting vertigo. He then inhaled slowly but deeply and took a seat on the now empty couch. Dan and Emma shared an uneasy glance as Timo leaned back and looked upwards. "Alessandro found a comet," he eventually said, speaking the words to the ceiling.
To be precise, a previously undetected multi-kilometer-long period comet.
How far away? Dan asked. When's the next pass? How close will it come?
Timo looked down from the ceiling and met Dan's eyes. He said nothing.
How close? Dan repeated. What kind of effects are we looking at? Is this something we can observe, or is this something we need to worry about?
From where Emma was standing, Timo's manner had already answered Dan's second question better than any words could. And still, words eluded Timo.
Timo!
Dan snapped, sharpening his tone rather than raising his voice. Timo nodded several times, almost rocking rather than nodding, then finally spoke again.
If it's left to approach unchecked, the destructive effects will be unprecedented. You asked how close it will pass. The answer from Alessandro is that it won't.
Now it was Dan's turn to fall silent. Now it was Dan's turn to turn pale.
And not just Alessandro, Timo continued. Unfortunately, my staff are insistent that if this comet is left unchecked, there will be no passage at all. In Alessandro's words, after multiple distinct observations, our computers, the best in the world, have calculated the impact probability as effectively 100%.
The data is wrong, Dan said, his voice weak. Tell them to check again. Are they factoring in?
They're factoring in everything,
Timo butted in. He took no pleasure in interrupting, but he saw no sense in allowing false hope to develop.
The models have come on leaps and bounds in the last few years, and those models are unanimous.
Dan turned away, as though burned by the heat of a fire. Emma took over.
So when you say long period, what exactly does that mean? The time it takes to loop around the sun?
Exactly,
Timo said, slightly more at ease now that he had spat out the basics of the horrible discovery.
It means it takes a long time to orbit the sun. In standard usage, long means anything over 200 years. For some comets, it can reach millions of years.
So what about this one? How long does this one take?
Emma asked.
The current estimate is an orbital period of 90,000 years. Something in that range.
Emma perked up.
Estimate? In that range? So none of this is definite?
The important parts are definite,
Timo replied, shaking his head gloomily. Given the distances and timescales involved, even extended observation won't give an exact orbital period. But we know where it is, we know where it's going, and we know how fast it's moving.
So how long do we have? She asked.
Dan turned around to face Timo again.
And how long do we need to do something about it? He added. Because there must be options, maybe something bigger and stronger than DS-1, or even any of the speculative technologies other people talked about last year when some people thought the first plaques were warning us about an asteroid? Anything. Bearing in mind that the whole world will be working on this, that money will be no object, and that we won't be wasting time on safety checks or testing, how long would you say we need to have a chance?
Well, Timo sighed, blowing air from his lips. Knowing what I know about the status of the kind of projects you mentioned, and being realistic rather than optimistic, I would say that to develop anything capable of dealing with something of this size, we would need around 3 years, if everything went smoothly. But the problem we face is...
And how long do we have? Emma repeated. Unchecked, when would it hit?
Timo's voice fell to a whisper as he delivered the most painful blow of all. 9 months.
Impact. Ford Residence, Birchwood, Colorado.
9 months, Dan said, speaking breathily in disbelief. Months?
Timo nodded. It was the nod of a defeated man.
2 questions, Emma said. 1, is this data absolutely infallible? And 2, how many people know about it?
The data becomes firmer with every passing minute, Timo said. But Alessandro was a man of science, and the words he chose to convey the impact probability, even at this early stage, were effectively 100%. As for your second question, at this point I'd say the number is probably around 10.
Probably, she parroted, and probably around 10? So by the time you wake me up, the horse is already bolted?
Emma, I just found out. These people are astronomers, not politicians, and one observer can be wrong. Multiple observers at one facility can be wrong. Alessandro showed this to his colleagues, people you've met. And when they told him he wasn't crazy, they asked staff at some of our other facilities to perform their own observations and analysis. Only then, when it became decisive, did he bring this to me. But politicians or not, everyone who works in my facilities understands the importance of a delicate touch here. The news won't have left those facilities. Not yet.
Not yet? Dan echoed.
Exactly. This isn't the kind of thing we could keep secret if we wanted to, and it's not the kind of thing we should try to keep secret.
Emma was nodding.
That's not even an option. But there are certain ways for bad news to come out, and seriously, when the news is this bad, the way it comes out can be the difference between sporadic riots and the total collapse of society.
Right, but there is a distinction to be made, Timo said. There is a difference between passing this information on to people who can use it and announcing it to the public without any thought for what happens next. If Godfrey had found this before we did, or if NASA had found something like it a few years ago, they would have begun preparations long before the public found out. Of course, there is a chance of amateur observation, and of course that becomes inevitable as time passes. But for as long as possible, preparations must be carried out under the radar. This is a case where early public knowledge could be absolutely fatal for public safety. If this is on the news in a few hours, I fear that we are done for. Chaos in the streets, looting and rioting, shelves empty, banks closed, utter lawlessness when the police and security forces stop turning up for work, since money means nothing if there's not even going to be a world in 9 months. Just absolute anarchy. So, Dan, do you see why not everyone can know about this? At least for now.
Obviously, Dan said, but you literally just said that we have 9 months and need 3 years. What are you going to prepare, a seating plan for who gets to sit in the front row when this thing crashes into us?
I estimated that we'd need 3 years to prevent an impact, Timo clarified. You already know that I have paid attention to this kind of thing over the past year, the field of planetary defense. But there are distinctions to be made between avoidance, mitigation, and all manner of other measures. Unfortunately, unless the GSC has a lot more than I think, physical interception is completely off the table.
Dan, who had always been interested in this kind of thing, already firmly suspected that the timescale was too short for a Hollywood-style mission to take out the comet before it got too close. Emma, who had seen all of those movies, was immediately reminded of a conversation between Timo and Billy Kendrick on Focus 2020, in which Billy had specifically mentioned a long-period comet as being amongst the likeliest extinction-level threats that could emerge when it was too late to act. Being reluctant to spread fear, Emma hadn't liked the fact that they had talked about such things, and now that those fears had been proven well-founded, she liked it even less. And although she was no defeatist, if the chance of doing anything effective in 9 months was as slim as Dan seemed to think, then Emma couldn't see how a 9-month societal descent into apocalyptic chaos was any better than having no warning at all. In her professional opinion, it seemed only too likely that the mere revelation of the comet's approach could destroy humanity long before the impact had a chance. 9 years would have been doable. 9 seconds would have been merciful. 9 months would be hell. But, Timo went on, even with only 9 months, there are certain things we can do. Dig, for one. I wouldn't be at all surprised if significant emergency bunkers already exist in this country and elsewhere, but I can certainly try to either expand those or construct our own. The alternative to going down is going up. I'm not going to pretend that I've looked into this particular option very much, but it seems reasonable to explore whether we could survive within Earth's atmosphere if we were in a high-altitude vessel on the other side of the world when the impact hit, to see out the worst of it. Dan shook his head, almost imperceptibly. Timo's heart was always in the right place, but Dan couldn't so easily turn his mind towards solutions that could, at best, save a tiny portion of the world's population.
How long until we can see it with just our eyes? Emma asked.
I didn't ask, Timo said. Perhaps something like 4 months? but I would be stunned if it's not independently observed long before naked eye observation becomes possible. You're the expert, and something tells me this isn't going to be up to either of us anyway. But my take would be that the public has to find out through official channels so the message can be managed. It then becomes a trade-off of how long to wait. The ideal time is as long as possible before an amateur astronomer spots it. Even a month would give us some time to get around a table, us being my staff and all the old NASA, ESA, CNSA, and Roscosmos teams at the GSC. And that would at least give us a chance to talk about how to keep things stable while we pursue whatever we can pursue. Alessandro was waiting for me to give him the green light to bring some GSC personnel in on this, because they, and only they, have access to any space-based observational equipment. The major telescopes can be pointed towards it, and distant probes can be redirected towards it to give us more information about its composition, which is going to be crucial if we have any chance at all. We're way past politics now, and we really do need to bring them in on this, ASAP. So, green light? Emma nodded. Dan? Go for it, he said. But even I know there's no such thing as being past politics. The comet could be 5 minutes away and those idiots would be arguing about who gets to give the last speech. Timo heeded their argument, sending a brief text message to Alessandro to authorize the sharing of his observational data with high-ranking GSC officials who reported directly to Chairman Godfrey. What about the plaque? Dan asked when Timo was finished. He aimed the question at no one in particular. Are we going to tell anyone else how Alessandro knew where to look? Not yet, Emma answered simply and decisively. One thing at a time. Dan was glad to hear this answer, both parts. As the initial gut-wrenching shock of the comet news had begun to sink in, his mind had started wondering about the nature of the plaque's message. The previous year, those optimists who didn't see the first two plaques as warnings of a potentially disastrous rendezvous with an asteroid or comet argued that it made little sense to think that the messengers would care enough to warn the citizens of Earth, but not enough to protect them. The technology required to traverse the stars and deliver a series of plaques implied an ability to shunt off course or otherwise disturb a would-be impactor, they argued. And as such, the warning hypothesis made little sense. Those plaques were fake, as Dan McCarthy knew only too well. But the fourth plaque, only too real, brought up the same question in his mind. Why would they warn us when they could save us? Even more perplexing was how the messenger's stated doctrine of minimal necessary intervention fitted into this. It struck Dan as fairly obvious that the most minimal intervention in this case would have been no intervention at all, and that the fact one had been deemed necessary clearly implied that the messengers had deemed humanity worthy of protection. The problem, thus, was logically circular. It also struck Dan that even assuming humanity had been deemed worth protecting, and that intervention was thus necessary, preventing a potentially catastrophic impact without alerting humanity would have been considerably less invasive and destabilizing, i.e., more minimal, than alerting humanity of a problem it had insufficient time to deal with. In turn, this consideration of the timescale raised yet another question. Why the hell did they leave the warning so late? I'm with Emma on that, Timo said. The plaque has to wait. It's done its part, and for now we've done ours. I'm sure we'll hear from Alessandro in the next few hours as updates come in. Emma sat down again as a ponderous silence circled. I'm glad we know, she said, breaking it very suddenly. It's better to know. And we're definitely telling Clark and Tara, Dan said, looking at Timo as he spoke. Definitely, Emma concurred. Timo gave a half-nod, half-shrug. He didn't look too concerned either way, and knew he would have been outvoted by Emma and Dan and powerless to stop them anyway. So what's it called? Dan asked. Comet Bonucci, after Alessandro? For the first time since arriving, Timo broke into a slight smile. No. He wanted nothing to do with it. Do you remember Luisa and Francesco from your time at the Cavalieri Observatory? Luisa Conti, the observatory's director, and Francesco Abate, its senior researcher? They were the first to corroborate Alessandro's findings, so it's going into the books as Comet Conte Abate. Unofficially, Alessandro has christened it
Il diavolo.
I'm guessing that means the devil in Italian?
Dan said, half asking.
You guess correctly, Timo confirmed. Il diavolo is the most potent foe of all.
The silence that followed this statement lasted far longer than any before it. Dan sat down next to Emma before long. Her head rested on his shoulder as soon as he did.
Do you think we should wake Tara and Clark to tell them now? He asked.
No,
Emma said, speaking very quietly as she listened to his heartbeat.
I know I said it's better to know, but there's literally nothing either of those two can do about this. So we might as well let them have a few more hours. Ignorance is bliss and all that.
Timo stood awkwardly next to the couch. Dan, do you mind if I go back to the basement?
Knock yourself out, Dan said. But if you see Clark, don't let on. I'm telling him.
Understood. And Emma, I'm sorry to have woken you at this hour. Needs must, as they say.
Emma almost let out a slight laugh at Timo's unexpected apology.
Don't worry about it.
And with that, Timo was gone. After a few minutes of thinking Emma had fallen asleep on his shoulder, Dan felt his own eyes closing.
They're not really going to leave us all to die, she suddenly said, jolting them open again. Are they?
No, Dan replied, gently kissing the top of her head.
We know what they told us at Lolo, and we know they're on our side. If something like this doesn't merit a decisive intervention, I don't know whatever could.
Dan was desperate to believe his own words, but they sounded a lot more convincing to Emma's ears than his own.
C plus one. GSC Headquarters, Buenos Aires, Argentina. William Godfrey stood in his office, face to face with a worried-looking advisor. This man, Manuel, was the closest thing to a confidant Godfrey had left within his ever-shrinking inner circle. None of the fake tidbits of relatively trifling information Godfrey had shared with Manuel throughout the previous year had ever come back to him in the form of secondhand gossip, which was more than could be said of similar information he'd shared with others to test their loyalty. Manuel was a straight-shooting family man who firmly believed in the GSC's mission and possessed keen instincts, which Godfrey had come to trust almost as much as his word. Today, Manuel wore an expression of concern like none Godfrey had seen on him in the past. He arrived clutching a single sheet of paper, which he handed to Godfrey when asked, then stood quietly as the GSC chairman read the short message.
"This is verified?"
Godfrey eventually asked, after reading the impossible words for the fourth time.
"Fully, sir," Manuel confirmed. "By staff at several facilities."
"And the original tip came from Fiori's people? They sent their data to us? No strings? I haven't missed some public announcement, have I?"
Godfrey asked, scrambling to turn on the wall-mounted TV. Manuel gestured towards the memo.
"This is all I know, sir."
There was nothing on Blitz News about an extinction-level comet hurtling towards Earth, so Godfrey breathed a sigh of relief that the situation was under wraps, for now at least.
"Manuel, right now I need you to make sure that everyone who knows about this also knows how important it is to keep it under wraps until we can get on top of things. I'll make sure everyone understands that very soon, but can you get the ball rolling in the meantime while I take care of something else?"
"Absolutely, sir. Only those with high clearance in relevant departments have seen this, but I will ensure that the consequences of loose lips are fully understood. And, sir, can I offer any assistance with the something else?"
Godfrey opened the door for Manuel, an upstanding individual of the kind he would have loved to have a building full of, and politely ushered him outside.
"Thank you, Manuel," he said, gently patting him on the back. "But that's all for now."
With Manuel gone, Godfrey sat at his desk and picked up his phone to call reception. His single spoken order was a simple one.
"Put me through to Timo Fiori."
C plus two. Ford Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. When Tara woke early to find Emma and Dan curled up on the couch, quiet but awake, Emma stuck to her earlier decision to afford Tara a few more hours of blissful ignorance. Watching the news,
was a sufficiently convincing explanation as to why they were there. Emma's bedroom contained no TV, and Dan had recently switched on the living room's projector, and Tara didn't pay enough attention to their expressions to know that anything was wrong. It wasn't until Timo arrived with Clark, not long before noon, that blissful ignorance's time finally ran out.
"So what's the big secret?"
Clark asked immediately upon entering Emma's house, evidently on the basis of what Timo had told him so far. Dan wasn't annoyed by this. The main thing was that Timo hadn't told Clark what the secret was. Emma called Tara into the room, as keen as Dan to get this over with and to make sure they only had to do it once. This time, Tara did notice their tellingly grim expressions. "Alessandro found an extinction-level comet when he was looking towards the area the plaque told us to look in," Dan said, spitting it out in layman's terms. "If nothing stops it, it's going to hit Earth in 9 months."
"What? Why don't they stop it?"
Clark asked, diving straight into the heart of the dilemma and verbalizing a thought Dan had been wrestling with all morning.
"If they're on our side, why warn us when they could save us?"
"I don't know yet," Dan said, throwing in the "yet" for his own benefit as much as anyone else's. He then turned to Tara to see how she was taking it. The color had drained from her face, and she had already sat down, so the answer seemed to be, "not well."
"What if it's maybe not actually a comet?" she said, trying to clutch on to some faint hope. "What if it's the messengers? Maybe it's their ship."
"Doesn't their craft travel at the speed of light?" Clark asked.
"No," Dan said. "Well, I guess there's a chance, but we don't know that it does. What I know for sure, what they told me, is that their craft is powered by light. That doesn't mean they move at the speed of light. Think of a remote-controlled car with a solar panel on top for recharging the battery. Powered by light, but that's all. Their craft could be the same."
"So it could be them?"
Tara asked, her tone now bordering on desperation. Dan deferred to Timo, who shook his head.
"The observed size and the early composition analysis are quite conclusive on that," Timo said. "But Tara, none of this is to say that we are helpless. There has to be a way to deal with this, and my team is going to work with the GSC to find it. You don't have to like Godfrey to recognize that the existence of the GSC framework is going to be a big plus here in terms of facilitating and hastening the kind of scientific and political discussions we need to have. So it really could be worse."
"Here's the other thing I don't get," Clark blurted out,
his tone tinged with an angry kind of confusion more than helpless fear.
"How does this fit in with everything else? Dan, you think they gave us a plaque so it was undeniable that the message on it came from them, right? But how does this fit in? It's just a star map that showed us the way to one system, and even I know that comets move fast as hell, so surely this plaque is only a relevant warning at this specific time. How does that make any kind of sense in the context of Cluster's story about the craft being found in Toplitz 80 years ago? And without exposing the hoax, which they don't want us to do, how the hell can we ever explain that this came from a plaque? Are we even going to try?"
Clark's was a question Dan had already thought about, but that didn't mean that he had come to any real conclusions. He had concluded that they would likely share the plaque, particularly if complacent thoughts that the messengers might stop the comet became prevalent, but the issue of how its content made sense was a difficult one to deal with. If the plaque's star map had led to the discovery of New Kerguelen as initially hoped and expected, everything would have been a lot more straightforward. As it was, straightforwardness was in short supply. "It is possible to fit this new plaque into the existing narrative," Dan said. "It's kind of like if I told you to look towards a certain tree in the distance so you could see a bird that was about to fly in front of it. There are limits to how far away a given object can be observed from, so I don't think it would be too much of a stretch for people to think that the messengers knew this comet's long-term path and knew that we would first see it by looking in this one specific direction."
"Hopefully that ends up being the kind of thing we have to worry about," Emma chimed in. "Message management is something I can handle. If we hear some feasible solutions from the GSC in the next few days, I'll be happy to worry about fitting the fourth plaque in with the rest of the story."
"So we're telling the GSC about this soon," Clark said. This wasn't a question, but rather an approving statement.
"We already have," Timo replied, "via the observatory.
There's no time to waste. Alessandro and the others he's spoken to won't say a thing in public. They understand as well as we do that this has to be handled delicately. But if weeks begin to pass with no progress behind the scenes, there's only so long that silence can last. And if this news gets out the wrong way... Very suddenly, Timo's phone began to ring. Its high-pitched tone was so loud and shrill that it irritated Rooster into an uncharacteristic fit of